They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 be mine?
I should have rewatched the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes in anticipation for this, but I didn't.
Well, we didn't really realise it was going to happen like now.
Yeah. Although I did have a really hilarious conversation with my dad. I'm going to say this quietly because I don't know if you can hear me. But we went to the cinema the other day to see Harry Potter.
Uh-huh.
And there was an advert for the new Sherlock Holmes movie.
Yeah.
And as we were coming, the Game of Shadows. And as we were coming out of the cinema, I was talking to him about what films he would like to watch next at the cinema, and he was like, oh yeah, I fancy like watching Sherlock Holmes. And then he started like imparting loads of wisdom about Sherlock Holmes to me. Which is really funny. He was like, yes, and he was killed at Reichenbach Falls, you know, by Professor Moriarty. And I was like, oh really? And then he was like, my favourite character is Moorcroft. And I was like, what? Well, oh, Mycroft! Oh, I'm with you. it was quite funny. And he was like, yeah, it's really sad that I know where Sherlock Holmes was killed. And I was like, yeah.
Not really.
All right, hello, good listeners, and welcome to episode 5 of the Baker Street Babes. Today we have a new babe with us, Taylor. Say hello.
Hello.
And we're going to be, once we've done our little introductions, talking about the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes movie. It's a beautiful little music.
Music's fantastic.
It is, I like the music in the film. But we'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay, fine. So Taylor is the newest Baker Street Babe. We have added her onto our merry crew, so we are now 6? 5?
A number.
You're a number. Well, it's you, me, Jen, Turk, Artie. So that's 6. Is that right? Yes.
Yeah.
There's 6 of us. I could do numbers. Speaking of Artie, she's stuck in purgatory, Skype purgatory, for some reason.
Yes, we may, at one point in the podcast, Artie may appear, but we don't know. It's like a mystery. So we will see. I actually did a little dance there, but obviously you guys can't see it, so there wasn't much point.
Okay, so Taylor, how did you get into Sherlock Holmes?
Well, it's fitting that I'm on this episode because, I don't know if it's sad, I almost want to add sadly in front of it, but yes, the Guy Ritchie movie was what did it for me. I don't even know why. I guess the spell of Robert Downey Jr. sucked me in, and then the second it happened, I was like, I think I'll read Sherlock Holmes. And then, literally, right after I finished reading the stories, we had the 2000 BBC Sherlock come out. So, I've been kind of working my way backwards through Granada and things like that, having started here with the Ritchie film. So, it's a lot of fun, and what's really kind of sad about it, though, is that a lot of people give the Ritchie film kind of some crap about, because it's not very canon accurate in a lot of places, but the reason I like the film so much was that out of the screen productions I had seen, it was one of the more accurate. Because I had not watched the Granada series, I had only seen, you know, the occasional films that come out with that, the Rathbone and things, which are brilliant films of their own merit, but it's not the portrayal of, particularly the portrayal of Watson in the new film is what got me, I think. I was like, that's Bam, and that's what he's supposed to be. He's supposed to be, you know, a crack shot, and he's not a bumbling idiot. And I see that. But that's where I got into it.
Who's your favorite character?
I'm a Watson fan.
Yay!
Oh god, I like Watson, but man, you guys are like way higher than a Sherlock fan.
He's just so awesome. I think that's why a lot of people like Baskerville so much, too. I hear a lot of people say that's their favorite. It's a very Watson story, a lot of it.
This is true. What's your favorite story?
This is kind of an odd one, because I don't think I've ever heard anybody say this, but I love the Red-Headed League for no particular reason.
That wrong! Episode 2, someone said that, because I listened to it today.
You don't hear it very often, though. It's not one you hear a lot, because it's one of the kind of later part of things. But it's my favorite, I think, by far, and I'm not even... I also really, really like The Speckled Band. Now, that I hear a lot.
And your favorite adaptation?
I really would have to say the BBC, and that's, I don't know if it's just because I haven't, you know, I watched it before I saw the Granada series, or if it's just that I like the updating. I think it's so very clever in the way that they take, you know, the littlest things, like the idea that you're equivalent to telegraphs or text messages and things like that. I think that's why I like it so much, is because it really, it takes a story that you would have appreciated in a certain time and brings it into our time, so that you can kind of appreciate certain aspects of it the way they would have been thought of originally, instead of seeing them as that kind of nostalgic, time-based setting.
Well, they make a point of like making it look really modern as well, so that you're never really like fooled into thinking it's anything but like a modern adaptation. And like it's really clever how they like then include like chronological references.
Yeah, I think they include a lot of stuff, and it's the way that they do it. Allows the idea with the adaptation is a lot more about the actual story and about the characters themselves than about the setting. And that kind of tends to happen with some of the adaptations that are set in the Victorian era. A lot of it is about literally the feel of the area and the time. Mm. And they do a good job of taking the plots and making them more foreground than the setting. It almost becomes incidental that it's in a modern era.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, actually. And I think, that's probably why the Guy Ritchie movie works quite well, because it is, you know, it's a Hollywood movie, and it's geared towards an audience that expects to see certain things on the screen. So the story, there's the kind of, like, quirky, or it's in the Victorian times, but it is, you know, I think, more about the story. We can talk about that now.
I think, I forget what article it was or someone, but said that the Guy Ritchie movie was sort of like MTV's version of Victorian London. Cause like, if you compare it to, like, just say the Granada version, they're very obviously different in how they portray Victorian England. And I think the Ritchie film does a lot more with like the industrialization, like maybe like the dirtier and grittier part as Hollywood is want to do. Yes,
there are more explosions.
It almost has like a steampunk element.
Yes.
Yeah, I noticed that actually. I think that's probably
not
originally
quite why. I think it makes it more relatable for people in the younger generation, the idea of things like that, taking it and taking the Victorian era and not taking it from the point of view of that it was a stodgy, dressed up era, and instead looking at the working class and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, blowing things up.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. My
favorite ridiculous part is the steam engine bit, when it's just like everything's falling, and then somehow through all of this, the boat just like goes out and sinks. And like that was really dramatic, but I enjoyed it. So
We're just like we're of that generation where we kind of expect to see kind of shiny things on the screen, so that kind of delivers in that way. But I think the steampunk idea is probably originally why I went to watch it with my friends, because we're quite into steampunk and dressing up like Victorians. You know, I've already told that story.
Yeah.
But you know, it was good. I mean, having not read any of the books like at that point, I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed. You know, Jude Law as Watson, which is why now when I read the stories, like, I basically just see him. You know, he is the stereotypical, well, he is the portrayal that I like the most, in that he's the right kind of age, and he has that kind of, the right kind of mannerisms, and he's smart in his own way, but he's obviously not as smart.
But he's still, like, very loyal and sort of follows after Holmes with kind of like, okay.
All right. Alright then, fine. We'll go do that thing.
In the Ritchie film, they really set up Holmes and Watson as an odd couple.
Yes, like that the bromance in that film is fantastic.
Oh yeah, the subtitle we had for the film was Sherlock Holmes, the breakup movie.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think that the bromance between Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law is so strong that I don't think they could have done it any other way.
they can't resist.
It's just on screen. Them. That very exasperated Watson, just kind of begrudgingly, very loyally following Holmes through his kind of insanities. It's an interesting portrayal, because even though he can hold his own a lot more than you normally see in screen adaptations of Watson, and he's definitely smarter, and he still has that loyalty and that he just follows along still, to a certain extent.
Oh, I had a thought, and it went away.
Do you have some questions for us, Christina?
I do! We got a few. Oh, I don't want to go into Irene right now.
That's true.
Oh, there's so many questions there about her. Okay, well, here's, like, I guess more of, like, a comment from someone. This is from Hello Mr. Narwhal on Tumblr. Amazing.
That's an awesome name. I just have to say, that is an awesome name.
The comment is, I found the movie invigorating because my previous experience with Holmes merely consisted of watching him in the 22nd century. He was a BAMF in the TV series, but it can't hold a flame to his awesomeness in the Guy Ritchie movie. I will definitely be checking out the books later and can't wait until the second movie comes out. So I think that's actually quite a controversial statement. Most people probably wouldn't agree with him, but it's interesting because Robert Downey Jr.'s Holmes is quite different from the canon. There's a lot of contradictions. It's very Hollywood, but he did do a really fantastic job, and I believe he got an Oscar nom for it as well.
He did, yeah. I mean, there was an interesting comment that one of my friends at work made at the time the film came out, because obviously Robert Downey Jr. is also in Iron Man.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, you know, Robert Downey Jr. is, you know, a recovering drug addict. And, you know, Tony Stark in Iron Man is an alcoholic. Ah, he's the perfect person to play him. You know, Sherlock Holmes is a cocaine addict. Ah, oh, Robert Downey Jr. is the perfect person to play him. And I was kind of like, what? But that was an interesting little anecdotal point that was made there. So although he doesn't look, you know, like perhaps the Sherlock Holmes that we imagine, perhaps, you know, he has something in common with him.
He's short and he has brown eyes. How is he Sherlock?
I know.
It is quite adorable to see him so much shorter than Watson.
I know, that is funny. He doesn't have that same sense of superiority.
No. And, like, because Sherlock Holmes is, he's put together very well, but the flat's always a mess. So they took that sort of, like, to the extreme with Robert Downey Jr.'s Holmes of being this really scruffy, like, lack of hygiene, as Watson puts it. Steal my clothes.
Things that hit people as being different from canon, a lot of them aren't necessarily different, it's exaggerated.
Yeah.
Fighting scenes and things, you know, we know that Holmes was a boxer, since he could fight, but he never actually really does that in canon. So they just take something that's suggested that you know is there, and then use it as a more major point.
I think one of the things I noticed about the film that I didn't think was as overstated as that. I mean, obviously, like when he's in the boxing match, he does the whole like deducing how to punch somebody perfectly to knock them out. Which, as somebody who does martial arts, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen in real
life. You're not Sherlock Holmes.
Obviously, you know, I can't deduce how to punch somebody perfectly in a split second, but I'm pretty sure that doesn't happen in real life. But one of the things that I like a lot about that film, and I noticed it the first time I watched it, and it's a very understated moment when he's sat in the restaurant waiting for Watson to bring Mary so they can meet for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And he sat there and he observes everything around him. Like he sees like waiters stealing cutlery and people having arguments, and nothing is ever said about that scene, but you can see it's sort of a moment where like it almost becomes too much for him. Like he wants to retreat from it all because he can't help noticing absolutely everything that's going on around him. And it's obviously you know, it gives him a headache or whatever, he kind of clutches his head, and you just kind of, that kind of moment, you feel, you know, a little bit sorry for him, because he can't ever stop being what he is, and that's what makes him so smart, but probably so, you know, removed in that particular adaptation where he just, you know, sits in his room all day in this disgusting mess. As, you know, Watson describes it, because he just can't handle being out in public that much because of what he can do, which I thought was an interesting point to have made, and I don't know if people have picked up on that as much, but you know, I noticed it.
You know, it also gives you an idea, too, of how you're looking at that mess in that room, and you're saying, oh, it's such a horrible thing, but the knowing how he sees things, you can see how, in that pile of stuff, he sees everything exactly where it should be.
Yeah. What my room is like.
Yeah, it is, like, when, like, things are messed, like, everything is in its proper place, and I think he actually says that. He's like, don't move anything, I know where everything is.
It's just an interesting point about, like, how do you display that kind of, you know, super intellect, without using too many words, which obviously is a little bit easier in cinematography. Nowadays, in the way that Guy Ritchie seems to do it. He likes his slow-mo. He loves his slow-mo.
He loves his slow-mo. The new trailer for Game of Shadows is pretty much 90% slow-mo.
But it looks so good.
Shiny, shiny. Well, hopefully it'll be as good as the trailer looked, quite exciting.
Yeah. I'm hoping it will, because freaking Stephen Fry
in
Minecraft.
Mycroft might be the best thing that's happened since Gaydos Mycroft.
Yes. He's like a national treasure.
I'm quite excited to see, especially how Robert Downey Jr. and Stephen Fry are going to play off of each other. That's going to be so amusing to see, and really interesting, because I don't think have they ever worked together?
No, they haven't, and not that I know of anyway, and I really, it's almost like I can't picture it yet.
Yeah, we haven't seen anything.
Well, Stephen Fry is very tall as well. Like
he's been a dwarf, Robert.
Yeah, they might have to put him on like a box.
They put him in lifts for the movie. They do put him on. They put lifts in his shoes for the film.
Really? Bless. That's what they do for Tom Cruise because he's so small.
Ooh, Artie! Artie's good.
Yay!
Artie's
yay!
Good. Okay,
yay,
hold on.
Surprise, Artie!
Oh, that's a terrible sound.
Hello?
Yay!
Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
We were talking about Stephen Fry and how much taller he is than Robert Downey Jr.
Okay, right. Well, almost everybody is Robert Downey Jr.
The whole world, especially me.
Yes.
Well, you were taller than everybody.
Just so that everybody knows, yes, Kaffers is 6 foot tall.
Ridiculously tall.
She's on
pins. I am really, really, ridiculously tall. Well, we might as well answer the questions about Irene Adler, because we can't avoid them.
We've got a few, so I'm going to sort of wrap them up in general. What did you think of Rachel McAdams' portrayal, and why is there so much hate for her?
Let us all have a moment to ponder.
There is a difference between hate for her and hate for the fact that they made Irene a love interest. Because I don't like that they made her a love interest, but I think she's amazing.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you, like in that way, because I quite enjoyed her performance in the film. And the only bit that I didn't like was how subservient she seemed to the kind of mysterious figure, which I guess is meant to be Professor Moriarty, because I don't think she would be like that unless she owed him a debt of some kind.
I mean, he has to have some kind of massive blackmail material, otherwise she wouldn't act like that if you'd compare it to the way she acts in the rest of the film towards pretty much everyone else.
Yeah, so she obviously had some reason to do that, otherwise I don't think it wouldn't be that believable, because she was basically like kind of like, you know, screw you guys. I'm gonna do what I want.
Well, they took a very strong female character and even presented her as being really strong, and then about halfway through the movie, when you discover this link that she has, it suddenly changes the characterization of her, even to see her being, like you said, so subservient to someone else's will, when the concept of her character is that she's so smart and she's so clever and she's so strong-willed, especially for the time period.
Yeah, like, I love Rachel McAdams, but I'm actually in the camp that I really disliked her performance in the film. Like, I really wanted to like it, and there were some moments, like, when she's, like, getting the roses and stuff, I thought that was all very clever. But I just hated how, like, you guys were saying, like, she's so strong and clever, and then all of a sudden, it's just like, no. Your backbone is gone, and you're just like, but I'm in love with you. I want to have your babies. Let's go. It's just like, stop it. You're really annoying now, and you're not adding anything to this story.
She's not in the second film, is she?
No.
I think she's making some sort of cameo.
No, like, they could have done it so much better, but then, like, it's Hollywood, and they were trying to sell it for the sex, but then they didn't realize that a lot of Sherlock Holmes fans actually know the actual stories.
Yeah. Well, surprise, surprise! Some of us have read the books! I think, you know, we could quite easily descend into some kind of feministic rant about that particular portrayal quite easily. I will resist, though.
Yeah.
But I think it's quite telling of the kind of movie it is. Obviously, it's to attract a particular kind of audience. But then I think you can enjoy it and still kind of pick faults in it as well.
Yes.
And think, oh, you know, I didn't enjoy that particular part. They could have done it better. But overall, like, you know, I still quite enjoy the film.
It was kind of unnecessary, too, what they did with Adler, because they could have introduced just as easily an original character because of the way that they changed her so fundamentally from what she was in the stories.
Mm.
There was really no point in sticking that name on a character.
She could have been like a cameo character, you know, Irene Adler comes in, steals something, you know, Sherlock is annoyed and sulks for a day, and then, you know, the actual woman could have been someone completely different.
I do like Mary in the Guy Ritchie film. I quite enjoy her.
She's awesome.
I like that "I intend to" bit. I'm like, yeah! And then just like the bitch please look that Sherlock gives her.
She's awesome.
I like the bit at the end that really cracks me up is when she's got that absolutely massive diamond on her ring. And she's like, where did you get this? It's just so hilarious.
I like how she bails only Watson out of jail and Holmes has to hang around. Don't even try it.
But it's funny because she does still have this, like, the sympathy. She does like Holmes to a certain extent.
Yeah, and
like,
she understands their relationship. Yeah. She knows they're so close.
But at the very end, like, when he's hanging himself, she's the one who's like, John, take him down. No, she sees it, she gets it.
Yeah, she probably has a certain fondness to him towards the end, because she obviously figures out that he's the doctor, doesn't she? And that scene,
yeah,
like, kind of goes to see Watson, and is like, oh my god, it's my fault. And she's like, yeah, you go do something about that now. He's like, yes, ma'am.
You know, it is actually quite a touching point, because she's like, she tells him, like, I know you care about him as much as I do. But it's like, we're on the same side. I know you may not enjoy the fact I'm stealing your Watson, but...
That's not bad.
You know, that's one of the things that movie did very well, is the disguises.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's a big deal with the Holmes, you know, canon. The idea that he's so good at the disguises that he doesn't even look like himself.
I think that's the only thing that disappointed people about the trailer for the second movie, actually, that his drag is actually so terrible. Because you just think Sherlock Holmes could easily do better than that.
Exactly.
You know, what do we call it? Robert Downey Jr. is not, you know, the most attractive looking transvestite, but he could have done better than that.
I know it's not my best disguise, but it's like, you look wretched.
There are no words. There are no words.
And I'm sure it's for a comedic effect. It's like, you could do a lady. We know Robert Downey Jr. could do a lady if he wanted to.
You know, Holmes could do a lady if he wanted to. He does in the Laurie R. King books sometimes, which is hilarious.
It happens in the Raffles stories as well, like Raffles' sidekick Bonnie, like, dresses up as a woman in one thing, and like, it's so convincing that this old man like comes onto him, and then Raffles like refuses, like doesn't help him at all. It's really a mean scene.
Now, the thing I am most excited about for Game of Shadows is Watson's scarf.
Oh, Jess, you know what? probably said this already, but...
Is it your friend who did that?
Yes, one of my friends worked in the costume department where they make a lot of costumes for films, and she actually made some of the scarves for the new movie, which I think is really cool. So when we're watching it, we're gonna be like, oh my god, they're her scarves! But she also said, actually, this is just like an interesting kind of side point, that the costume department that they were working in had original costumes from the time periods that they were making costumes for. So the kind of stuff,
oh my god,
wow,
yeah, like things you could see in the V&A behind glass, they could get out and try on if they wanted to, and just like fiddle around with them. So they had like proper Victorian outfits and stuff that, you know, you would never in a million years, you know, think you would be allowed to like touch, but they just like play with them and like then like base the costumes.
That sounds so awesome.
I know, I was like super jealous.
I have so, a new book now.
Yeah, if anyone fancies getting into the costuming business, you know, that's the way to go.
Oh man, yeah. Like cinematography, the movie is stunning. Like all the costumes and like everything, it's beautiful.
As well, it's because it wants to sort of look like that grimy Victorian setting. You get like a lot of those nice visuals. I especially actually really like how they're building the bridge, like in it, like you see the sweep of like the scaffolding, like the skeleton of what's going to be
the Tower Bridge.
that bridge.
Not London Bridge. Let's get this straight.
I know, I was gonna say London Bridge. I was like, it's not London Bridge, it's the other one.
You shame England.
<I know. laughs> I've lived in the north for many years.
That's no excuse.
People in the north don't even know where London is. Actually true.
For all our northern listeners, we apologize.
We apologize.
Lindsay actually asked, Lindsay Faye, who will be our next episode, and she's amazing, and I'm not going to gush about her because I gush about her all next episode, but she asks... For real, how the hell is Baker Street laid out in the film? I need a floor plan. I need a floor plan. Is there a consulting room sliding door? Because it is quite an interesting layout that they have. Because we only see snippets, so you can't really put it together. But the consulting room is quite large.
Yeah, it definitely does have a sliding door, and you can see it in some of the sequences, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I think
kind of a thing they talk about a lot.
Yeah, I mean, when we were in the other podcast we did, obviously, like about Victorian houses, I mean, they weren't very big. And I think a lot of that has to do with, obviously, the cameras have to be able to move around inside a room. So sometimes, if you're not careful with the sort of the way you shoot it, it can look quite large, because obviously it's quite a big space that they're filming in. I know that they had that particular problem, if you've ever seen A Girl with a Pearl Earring, because the house that they're in is meant to be really tiny, and they actually manage it. Even though if you actually look at the set, like, it's massive just to fit the cameras in. So a lot of that has to do with the way that they film it. So it probably shouldn't be as big as it looks for it to actually fit inside a Victorian terrace.
I do like that you get to see Watson's sort of clinic room, though.
Yeah, it kind of gives him a space and a presence in an apartment that very much, particularly in that film, is Holmes's domain.
Yes.
It's like the cat that peed in the corner and said, "This is mine." I'm tired.
But they even referenced it in the dialogue. Like Holmes comes in and goes, like, "Well, this room isn't really yours anymore." You know, he's kind of packing up, but. You know, it's kind of they're at that awkward stage where you know someone's moving out, but, you know, you still have to share a place.
Yeah.
You know, and then he's like, "Well, it's not really yours anymore, so can I just dump a corpse here? Whatever."
What's a corpse between friends?
And I love that the guy's obviously taller than the table, so he's just kind of like half laying off of it.
Can we take a moment to just talk about how wonderful the music is?
Yes.
I was saying very briefly at the beginning that the Hans Zimmer score is just amazing.
It is incredible.
There's a video of the main theme of it also that Guy Ritchie and Robert Downey Jr. are actually in, and it's like a little music video of different musicians playing the theme and it all being like put together.
Oh, like, nice.
The violin separate from the, and it's a lot of fun. So if you get a chance to look that up, you should definitely do it.
If you know how to use YouTube.
Use the internet to your advantage.
The great and mighty tubes.
Yeah, like I normally never buy soundtracks, but I bought the soundtrack to this movie like right after I saw it. It's like, this is incredible. And I just loved all of it. And I was really happy that it got nominated for an Oscar, the soundtrack. Because it was just, it's beautiful and it's exciting and it makes me happy.
And it's got some unusual sounds in it with the, like, the harpsichord type tack piano.
Yeah.
Which you don't normally see in movie scores, are usually very strictly symphony.
Yeah, no, it's nice to hear interesting sounds, like, because it gives you a different experience, especially when you're in the cinema and you hear these noises and you kind of like, ooh, it adds to the atmosphere. But I enjoyed it. The score was very good.
It's playing in my head right now just from you guys talking about it. Yeah, it's wonderful how they like complement each other, because every time I listen to it, like the film is playing in my head, and when I watch the film sometimes I just notice the music. You know how I mean? Like,
yeah,
because and the music is kind of cues to certain scenes, like, you know, it comes on and you know, oh, this is gonna happen and this is gonna happen and this is when that happens. And to have a soundtrack that is that evocative, specifically evocative of specific scenes, is quite special. I don't think there's many soundtracks that do that to me.
Hopefully the second film will be just as good in that kind of the way they use the music to create the atmospheres.
What did we want to say about Blackwood as a villain?
I think what I quite like about that whole the film as a whole is it gives the same kind of message that you get from the Hound of the Baskervilles, in that you, the whole way through you're convinced that something like supernatural is happening, but obviously at the end, like, Sherlock reveals it all to be a complete hoax, and it's just Blackwood, you know, because he's really smart, he comes up with all these ways to fool people into thinking, you know, he's been, you know, had to deal with the devil or whatever,
mm-hmm.
In a way to like control people. But Sherlock is like, no, it's science. And that's kind of one of the messages that, you know, Sherlock Holmes is like, there's always an explanation, you know, however weird it may be. The least likely thing, you know, that could be it.
First saw the previews, I was angry at the fact that I thought it was like all supernatural. I'm like, why are you doing that? That's really stupid. And so you go in with this thought, and then it's like, it's science. That was clever.
I think that was good. I think that was a good thing, a good plot device to use to like draw people in, and then be like, aha!
Actually, I know a lot of people want to see it because of that, and then I told them after I saw it, I'm like, no, go, trust me. They're like, fine, and then they were happy.
I think it's also really clever because it doesn't adapt a specific canon story. And I think that is really clever, because the way they take these characters, you know, it's quite a stretch from canon. So you can accept it if you like the original stories. I think you can accept it because, you know, they take Holmes's methods and they take Watson the soldier. So you can kind of see that in there, but it's not a specific canon story, so it's kind of almost like an alternate universe, and I think that's very, very clever, because you're not gonna offend people who like the original stories, because they'll, you know, they'll not go, oh, that was an abomination. They'll just be like, yeah, well, whatever, at least they didn't, you know, ruin one of the stories for me.
And
at the same time, you have so many things that are taken. They have so many canon lines, and they have so many things that are, you know, very, very close to the original canon that, you know, there will still be a connection there. But it's also enjoyable for people who haven't read the canon, I'd say.
Yeah, because they had the shooting the wall bit.
And they have so many lines that are just directly from the canon if you listen to it.
Yeah, and the people who did the set dressing for that movie definitely deserve...
oh my god, yes.
The little things in the flat alone, if you get a still shot of the flat, I mean, they have the things that are very iconic of Holmes, like the Persian slipper with the tobacco in it, and the knife on the holding the correspondence to the mantle. But also, if you look in the room, there's a series of the dancing man figures taped to the mantle. And there's a whole bunch of little things like that that are very indicative of the canon, if you know the stories, and that you probably wouldn't even notice. Like, you really have to look for them. And I just think that's absolutely beautiful and wonderful for set dressing and just putting those little tidbits in there and keeping it all in one.
I must have had quite a lot of fun doing that as well. I was thinking set dressing must be quite fun. You know,
that's been like the most fun job ever.
Yeah, set dressing.
And it's not just the flat in that film, it's the Ginger Midget's lab as well. Like, every time that comes on, I just pause it and just have a look around, because that lab is just so full of... That's just amazing.
Yeah, I remember that bit. Actually, that's the bit that kind of makes us think kind of like of steampunk, I think, with all the kind of brass pipes and kind of bubbling.
Yeah.
He's got some awesome goggles going on at some point.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And like the little... The sunglasses are definitely that he wears in one of the scenes.
Yeah.
When they're going to the graveyard. They're very much a tip to the like the Russian homes.
Yes.
Oh, really?
And also the he tries to open the door with the key and Watson just kicks the door down. Also, that's from the Russian series.
Is it really? Oh, that's
from the Russian series as well, yeah.
So they kind of take little bits of all the different representations.
I didn't realise there was a lot of there is a lot of like little nods to different representations of Sherlock Holmes, which is quite nice, you know, if you're like a fan already, and then you come back later and be like, oh yes, now I understand.
Yeah, I've actually been to that graveyard that they used, and I didn't realise it at the time because my flatmate and I were just wandering around and taking pictures because we're artsy like that, and like walked out. I'm like, this place looks so familiar, and as we're walking out, it looked. I saw this, like, this little piece of paper saying, oh, Sherlock Holmes is filmed here. I'm like, oh my god! So then we went home and we watched it, and it came on. We're like, ah! It's like really clever how they shot it, because they just kept the camera angle really low. So you don't see like all like the skyscrapers and stuff. But I'm like, and what they use for the tomb is actually a staircase to like go under like this like promenade thing to go under and over to the other part of the graveyard. I'm like, that is so clever how you did that.
movie magic.
Movie magic. And then I was like, oh, I kind of spoiled the magic for me. Because like, now I'm like, seeing the scene, like, I know how you did that.
No, it's just clever how they do that, you know, because obviously they've got to be able to find these locations that look, you know, Victorian enough, which is hard enough in London.
And that is a beautiful graveyard. It's in Chelsea. So everyone should, like, go there because it's just really. And also really kind of creepy, because there's some parts that definitely haven't been touched up in quite a while. If you're a graveyard enthusiast.
Flamed rush of tourists in the graveyard.
From our podcast.
So what are, like, some people's favorite moments from the film?
Mine probably is the one I already talked about, like, where he sat alone in the restaurant and, like, noticing everything around him, and it's kind of like, ugh. For me, I kind of really sympathized with him in that moment, so I like that little.
I'm a big fan of the little bits of comedy in it, just the kind of really witty repertoire, like when Holmes and Watson are talking about the clothes sharing and the barter system and everything.
Yes. Oh yeah.
and the whole get that out of my face. It's not in your face. It's in my hand.
Yes.
That is coming back in the next one.
I know. I was so excited when I saw it. I'm like, yes.
It's funny without making Watson look like an idiot. That's what's so good about it.
Yeah, it's just so witty, and like their banter is just, it's spot on. It's brilliant. Like when they're after like Holmes is like finished like sleeping on Watson and they're in jail and he's like hitting up all night like, cataloging how fucking bizarre my life is. And then like after like all of this, it's like, now you're not making sense. Like, you're not human.
That one always hits me so hard when he says, you're not human, because, he just looks so lost in that moment. But since we're talking about favourite moments, I think my favourite, well, Watson's introduction is basically, he takes this guy out, and Holmes says to him, well, this is enough, you're a doctor after all. And that is how we meet Watson. I mean, you know, what a classy entrance is that?
gonna choke a bitch and then be slightly worried that it killed them.
Yeah, and then beat people with a stick, you know, and be a bamf, and totally own that scene with Blackwood.
Yeah, no, it was good.
Except for the part where he nearly walked into a glass spike, but
That is a nice there.
Just Watson's entrance, I think, is one of my favorite things in that film.
Jude Law's Watson in general is like,
yeah.
You're surrounded by Watson fans now.
Hey, I like John Watson. I love John Watson. I especially like Jude Law's John Watson. It's brilliant. And it is what, like, who I think of now when I'm, like, reading the stories, I think of him. Because he just did such a fantastic job of embodying the character and getting all the nuances and not being an idiot. And I love that he still has the cane and that he always, like, tilts his hat to the side.
The sword cane is a wonderful thing.
Oh, the sword cane. Do you know where I used to work? We had a gun cane as well.
Gun canes are awesome.
Nice.
Also get gun canes. Just putting that out there.
They're not very accurate, but they're cool.
Gun canes. They exist. Oh, and umbrellas, sword umbrellas as well.
I bet Mycroft's going to have one. I hope Stephen Fry's Mycroft has an umbrella.
just because. As a small nod.
I don't know if I'd be able to take that, honestly.
Can you?
I was going to say, I would actually die, I think.
when it happens, like if it does in the new movie, like, you'll hear like a certain number of people in the audience start laughing, and you'll just know.
Yeah.
Tell us about Rick Grace.
Oh, dear. Right. Any more questions?
Well, we have questions just for us as the Baker Street Babes. So I guess I'll read them.
Do a little special section on the Baker Street Babe.
This is from Saga City 19 on Twitter. Have you read or heard the audiobook of Sherlock Holmes: The Rediscovered Railway Mysteries and Other Stories by John Taylor? Wow. Marty.
Have you heard it?
Yes. And it's amazing.
There you go. What better recommendation could you need?
I'll explain.
Please
when I finish laughing.
I agree. Well, it's well worth it, but I will let you explain. I'm sure you're better at it than me.
It's four stories. It's read by Benedict Cumberbatch. They're written from Watson's point of view, which is hilarious in itself because the Cumberbatch is reading as Watson, which is just weird. He does an American accent.
Really?
Hilarious. Yeah, American woman. He does an American woman. Yeah, not that way, I know, I'm tired. But yeah, he tries to imitate the way that an American woman would speak, and it's hilarious because his American accent is actually really bad, but the woman part of it is decent. And the stories are, they're just crackfic. Very heterosexual, shall we say. They're really over the top, but raucously entertaining, very fun. I do recommend it, but maybe not on public transport if you're listening to it.
Your own health and safety.
The next one is from Y Jing Haiku on Twitter again, and he asks, have you seen the 1954 Sherlock Holmes series with Ronald Howard? So underrated, one of my favorite renditions.
I have not seen that version, but I will say that I've learned a lot about it because it's actually ends up being a big part of a big player in the copyright battle here in the US. Which I've been researching.
So we'll be talking about that next episode.
That will happen next time. I will get into that a little bit. I'd like to see it though, knowing, you know, some of the background on it.
Well, there's so many, it's difficult to keep up with them all actually, because obviously we only know of the really popular ones, but I always take note of them and think, okay, when I have time later, go watch that.
I know, there's like a whole treasure trove.
It was definitely on the card for the SH watch-alongs, so that's going to appear there at some point. I haven't seen it either, but it's definitely on the list.
Okay, that's really the only other question, because someone asked who would be cast as Moriarty in the Guy Ritchie films, but that's already out there, so... each other.
If we had a choice, if we had a fantasy casting.
Fantasy casting for the Guy Ritchie Moriarty.
Oh, what's his face?
Really?
His name has completely gone out of my head.
I would like Patrick Stewart or someone. Someone like really like old school British.
I'm gonna save this.
Oh God, Ian McKellen.
Oh. But with a view of, you know, knowing that Stephen Fry is playing Mycroft even, I would like to see Hugh Laurie.
Oh, man!
Oh,
amazing.
Good call.
Oh, that is our answer. Hugh Laurie. Hugh Moriarty.
Yeah.
I'm going to be really annoyed now because I've completely forgotten the name of this really famous actor. Sirius Black!
Gary Oldman!
Gary Oldman, there we go.
He would be. Too.
Yeah, you
love Gary Oldman. But we're gonna get a healthy dose of Gary Oldman because we got Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy
with an amazing cast.
Yeah, funny moment. Like I showed my sister the trailer, and her first thing was like, "Is this movie called Men I Should Sleep With?"
In the 1970s. Is that a wrap, ladies?
Yes. I think that is.
Yep.
Yeah, so next episode is with Lindsay Fay, who Jen and I interviewed this past weekend in New York City, and it's amazing and so freaking hysterical. She is a riot, and she's also so knowledgeable, like, about, because she wrote a pastiche, very critically acclaimed.
Dust and Shadow, is that?
Yes, Dust and Shadow. It's actually really good. It's really, really good. And the voice, like, I gushed about this to her, but her voice as Watson is dead on. Like, I'm reading it, and I swear I forgot that I was reading a pastiche.
Yeah, it was very good. I enjoyed it a lot. I read it earlier this year.
And it's about Sherlock Holmes solving the Jack the Ripper murders.
Oh, brilliant.
It's great.
Well, that's all for now, everybody. We will see you next time.
Yeah!
Alright, bye!
Bye!
Hello, everybody. I just wanted to give a big shout out to everyone who has supported us. We have a new store. It's www.cafepress.com/BakerStreetBake. We have mugs, stickers, shot glasses, because we drink a lot of water. But if you want to go check it out, it'd be amazing. We have three designs. We have the Baker Street Babes logo. We have 221 Be Mine. And we have a new one, which is Tell Us About Rupert Graves. I know, it's amazing. I actually have one of the mugs myself, and it's really exciting to see something that you've created and other people can kind of hold in their hands. It's really cool. So if you wouldn't mind going to take a look, that'd be really much appreciated. Also, we're doing a little bit of restructuring of the entire feel of the show. Caffers is moving to China at the end of the month, so we haven't really been able to catch up with Caffers Story Corner. We apologize for that, but she's really, really busy. Also, you can always find the news everywhere, so we're probably not going to have our news section as often, unless it's really big news. We do have some things today that we've just been privately working on, which is kind of cool. But thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of the show. We have a new song at the end. It's by Sam. We've almost run out of Caitlin's songs, so we're giving Sam a chance this time. It's called Ghosts of Baker Street, and it's really beautiful, and you should definitely listen to it. Okay, thanks. Bye. There's a new Sherlock Holmes Society in town. The Sherlock Holmes Society of Scotland is in Glasgow, and it is soon to be subtitled the Self-Important Scotland Yarders, founded by Barry Young. They have about a dozen people turn up at their first meeting. Now there's around 20 of us, with more coming in for the regularly monthly meetings in the library at the beautiful Glasgow Art Club in Bath Street. They're the only Holmesian society in the land of the literary agent's birth, which is actually quite surprising. I'm surprised about that. With three office barriers, the busybody, the meddler, and the Scotland Yard Jack in Office, they also give themselves canonical names. Barry himself is that malodorous experiment, for reasons that will become apparent should we ever meet them. And I would quite like to meet them. These guys are absolutely fantastic. And they started their own Sherlock Holmes Society, and that's amazing. They've sponsored a successful screening of The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes and are looking to collaborate with other societies to put on a Victorian evening of entertainment near Christmas with burlesque, magicians, singing, and a couple of Holmesian skits. So if you're in the Glasgow area, do go check them out. It would be really fantastic, and they sound like they're having so much fun. They discuss a new story each month. They don't take themselves too seriously, but they have fascinating talks about the stories in their context. When they did a dissection of the Five Orange Pips, they're talking about, you know, racism, segregation in Scotland as
well as in America, of course. So some fun, some seriousness, but a lot of Scottish lovin'. Barry has a blog, and it premieres on the Herald Scotland, Tales of a Secondhand Bookseller. We will put a link to it up on our website, so you go and check it out. The Sherlock Holmes Society of Scotland. It's going to be awesome. And Scottish. I can't do a Scottish accent. I'm sorry, Barry.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one be mine? You're lying on the sofa in the incandescent glow of the mess of books and furniture I've learned to call home. I find your hands are steepled and your silver eyes are closed. It's no elementary problem, says the voice I've come to know. I hear you sigh, the loudest sigh, and I jest that it's bizarre. You said that breathing's boring, oh, what a hypocrite you are. When the puzzle's broken, the cipher is your scar. And when your eyes fly open, they're burning like the stars. Oh, Mr. Holmes, let's meet with the ghosts of Baker Street, where the criminals and outlaws on their falling at your feet. To the gang we make a vow, chasing cabs and old bloodhounds, cause no one's safe in London town. Ooh, every day's a marvel when you're living with this man. Well, spinning through the city, try and catch us if you can. In the depths of boredom, he's shooting at the walls. He needn't ever speak a word, the bullets say it all. But what a life we lead within this never-ending war. Cause when you walk with Sherlock Holmes, you see the battlefield and more. We have brushed the blindest bankers and played the greatest games. Mr. Holmes and Dr. Watson, don't you dare forget those names. Oh, cabs and old bloodhounds, cause no one's safe in London town.